Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Today we cover Leviticus chapter 26 and 27, and also picked up a parallel passage there in Jeremiah chapter 16, verse 19, goes through 17, verse 14, and also saw a passage in Matthew chapter 22. When it talks about blessings and curses, these are things that actually happen in history, this idea of blessings and curses. We just talked about this when we're going through Galatians chapter 3 in our weekly Bible study, because we're talking about when it's mentioning about the kind of witnesses that the Lord is proving as being a witness to the covenant that Israel is making. You have to step back and ask, well, what kind of a witness is this? What kind of a covenant is this? Well, familiar ones that you see in the ancient world that were done, there are two main types of them. There's all kinds of variations within them, but there's two main types. One is what they call like a royal grant treaty. And that is basically the potentate, the ruler, the king, is just making a declaration, I will do this, and there's a recipient on the other end. So all the onus, every sort of stipulation, and the fulfilling of the promise is upon the potentate to make sure that this indeed happens. But one of the things that we see on the other side of that is what they call a suzerain or the great king, a suzerain vassal treaty. So you have a treaty between a great king or like an emperor and a vassal or like a lesser king or a ruler. Those typically were ones over a land that the emperor or the great king had conquered, but they could also be with little subsets of their land. Well, one of the things that you see as a feature of those types of contracts is that there is a listings of blessings and curses. You fulfill the contract, this is all the fantastic things that are going to happen. You don't fulfill the contract, look out. And all of those types of treaties, this suzerain vassal treaty, have those elements to it. So the ones that we see here in Leviticus 26, you'll notice them because they are very similar to what you see in the last chapters of Deuteronomy. Because again, this is a reiteration of the Sinai covenant with the second generation, with reborn Israel in the second generation that is going to go into the land. So again, you have this reiteration of the covenant. Now you'll notice that when we get to Deuteronomy in those last chapters, that the section in Deuteronomy is much longer than what you see here in 26. In 26, brief section, this is all how this relationship with the Lord is going to benefit you. And then it goes on, this is where it's going to go downhill and be very bad to the point of where it talks about, you know, it's going to get so bad that it's going to descend into cannibalism because there will be no other food. And people in the ancient world who were familiar with sieges on cities and heard about them would know that's typically what it descended into. If the people inside did not relent, did not surrender, that's what your fate would end up being, because one of the ways that you could go in to attack a city is you could plow right through the wall if you could, but that takes a lot of resources. And if it's a very well-made wall, then your way in is not going to be straightforward and it may take a lot of time. So like with a city like Jerusalem, you see how long it took with the siege involved. But without a supply of food and without water, now, that's one of the things that you'll see that came about with when they, when you even go today and you see the Hezekiah's tunnel. That's a feat of civil engineering that they did of a water tunnel to basically move water from a spring that was outside of the wall normally to a place where you could get the water inside the wall, which is great because then you have a supply of water. Because they, you know, all the time when they talk about survival, how long can you go without food? Maybe a month. Or even more. But without water, yeah, you're toast within 3 days. That's bad news. So supply of water is extremely important. But if you completely run out of food, it gets down to that bad situation. And that you see in not only historical accounts related to Jerusalem and its sieges, the one that happened under Babylon, and then the one that happened under Rome. And there are the accounts of that and how far that descended into disaster. But you see that happen in a number of other cases where you have holdouts and you have these incredible sieges that go on for such a long period of time. So with this particular piece of lead, that they have dug up there on Mount Ebal, and as we will read about going forward, we'll see that this is the Mount of Curses. We see that there were two mountains, Gerizim and Ebal, and that there was the Mount of Blessing and then the Mount of Curses, and that you had the separation of the tribes between the Mounts of Blessing and then the Mounts of Curses. We'll see more of that as we continue on into the next book. In this particular one that they've dug up, it's very significant because there have been a lot of assertions that archaeologists and historians had made. Well, people just dreamed up this... they dreamed up the Lord, you know, Yod-Heh-Wav-Heh, Yahweh, they dreamed this one up. It was not something that was in common practice until much, much later, maybe after the Babylonian exile, etc. Well, when they found this particular piece of, it's finely hammered lead. So they take lead, and of course, lead is soft, so they hammered it down into thin sheets. And then they folded it over and folded it over and folded it over. And they're down into this. These, you can see on that little scale bar underneath that these are very small. They're only, you know, just over an inch wide and almost square. They're a little rectangular here. And then they inscribed on these the curses. And so on this particular one that they've been able to decipher so far is, you know, cursed, 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 cursed by the God. And this one has just three letters on it, which is Yod, He, and Wav, that in the ancient, Hebraic script of the time period. So it's very interesting that we have this particular thing, because when you see blessings and curses, this is not some sort of thing that you'll see that people tried to come up with in the 1800s to say that, this was a later addition. They added this on to the Torah way later on down in Israel's history, like, you know, down into the 600s BC instead of at least double that time period earlier. But this particular one, it's dated based on the materials involved back to either to 1400 to 1200 BC on it. So one of the things that as we start into this discussion, this is not some sort of heat-stroked dream that is coming to us here. This is actually something that was a common approach that you would see in contracts and in things that would happen between so-called deities and the people involved. Well, one of the things that it was important to see from the book of Jeremiah was that in the midst of these blessings and curses, you saw that particular picture in there that there's those you know, chapters 30, 31, 32, 33, sandwiched in the midst of Jeremiah, that are a hint at, you've got the spectrum between blessings and curses, and that you've seen in there, and the elements that Jeremiah is bringing forward, that there is a whole lot of hypocrisy that is going on within the priesthood. They are claiming to serve the Lord, but who are they really serving in their hearts? Their self, and self, one way that that is expressed is in worship of deities, because you know, a lot of the pagan world is related to self. Even in, you see that today, it's related to self. And whether you even start getting into some of the Eastern religions today, a lot of that is related to self, self-actualization, self-aggrandizement. So you are taking yourself and moving it up further, you know, to the point of where you get to some of those practices where there is no deity whatsoever. It is just you yourself just elevate up. And once you reach your actualization, then you yourself are God, are the all that ever is. So as we move on into our passage that we're looking at here today, one of the things that we see is that these blessings are mirroring something we'll see in Deuteronomy 28. And one of the important things for this first generation out of the house of bondage, as it was for the second generation, was about entering his rest. Entering his rest. Now, one of the things, this is a foreshadowing, because when we see in Leviticus 26, when it talks about that, you know, you will see people fleeing. Now, one person will give chase and all bunch of people will flee as a part of the curses. That you are not confident in your ability to do this. Well, number one, that should be a hint. You're not confident in your ability to do this. But you're not confident in your ability to hold this land. It looks like that this force that's coming after you will be much, much stronger. When we get further on and we move into our next book, what do we see when you have this encounter? When they send the spies into the land, we start seeing at the end of Numbers. They send them into the land, and they get a report, and they come back. And 10 out of the 12 spies that go in have a bad report. You know, there's no way. We can't do it. The walls are too high. The people are too big. They're too well-equipped. There's no way we can do this. We are toast. Even though they've just been shown over decades, but first come the great plagues that freed the land, freed the people out of the land of bondage, but then also going through the Red Sea, being fed with bread from heaven, the daily bread, having the water from rocks, and on it goes, even victory against Amalek when Amalek attacked. So those were all parts of your history and your story. Now, when you get to the point of where you say, hey, this is a huge challenge that we're going into next, what do we do? Do we just look at our particular moment? We are just not able to do this. Well, then, yeah, you might say we're not well equipped to do this, but where has the Lord taken us up to this point? Even though we were not able to break the back of Egypt, we were freed. Even though we were not able to conquer Amalek, we conquered. Even though we were not able to feed us in the desert, we were fed. Well, this is all kind of talking in the passive, but who was the active actor in all that? God, the Almighty, the creator of heaven and earth. So, thus, what happened before and the promise that you would be delivered and returned into the land, you could see the fulfilling of that promise, the basically making good on the promise, making good on the oath, making good on the vows, which is a very important part of why we see vows here at the end of Leviticus as well. But a key part of this is going to see, we're going to see, is that it's about entering his rest, moving from bondage to rest, to freedom, from bondage to freedom, from being restless to being restful and having rest. So that's a key aspect that we'll see and as we move through in this particular promise. So one of the things that we see is that this Leviticus 26 contains all kinds of national blessings and curses, and the leadership contributes greatly to the direction of the people toward or away from God. Did you catch that with the passage that we read there in Jeremiah 16 and 17? And then as we zoomed out to look at all of Jeremiah, did you see that the leadership had a huge impact on how the trajectory of the people went? They did. Whether you're talking about national leadership, whether you're talking about your local group leadership, whether you're talking about down to your family leadership, all of these levels down are having a huge impact on where the trajectory of the whole nation goes on this. Are they moving toward God or are they moving away from God? And as we will see as we kind of move on even later into the book of Deuteronomy, where you see that a key part of the daily prayer, and we say that every Shabbat, and it's a part of our daily lives, this prayer from Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema, that you are to say these things, what? Just occasionally? Yes, but even more than that, you're to remind of these words when you wake up, when you go to sleep, through the day, whatever you're doing, you were to keep talking about this and keep showing this and not just talk about it, but actually living it out. So who sees it? The children. That is the most important aspect, that the children see it and that they're seeing that this isn't just some sort of Academy Award you're shooting for, but no, this is actually who you actually are. We call that character, that your character is what it is that you are saying. That's why the talking about the way that you live it is called halacha, or the way of walking. You are walking through life on a derech. So you halach, you walk on a derech. You walk along a road. The road that is laid out are the ways of the Lord. And so how you walk on it. So the point of life is that, you know, you're not out there continually doing Brody's out on the off-road thing, just spinning in the dirt and in the mud. No, you're walking on the path. Because what is one of the things that, if you do a lot of off-road sort of stuff, what is one of the things that is very unpredictable about being off-road? Stuck. Whether you're high-centered or stuck in a ditch or in the mud. On a road, unless you're in some roads that are incredibly badly maintained where you can probably lose a whole truck into a pothole, one idea of a roadway is to make the way smooth, to make the way better. Whether you're talking about one of the major innovations they talk about is with the Roman roads. With the Roman roads, they made it possible for the armies to move around, to be able to get to different locations very quickly. So thus, the Roman roads were a great innovation. But one of the things that you see in this particular illustrations that we'll see going on into both Numbers and also Deuteronomy is that you must choose leaders. You must choose leaders that are not able to. as we move on here further, one of the things that we'll see is that leadership contributes to where we're going, toward God or away from God. So it's one of those things that people will say, okay, don't get involved in politics. But one of the things that you say is that politics is downstream from culture, and culture is downstream from what? The family. So you don't like how things are going? What is that the cause by? Families have problems. So thus, the children have problems. And if the children have problems, then things outside of the family have problems. And then the side things outside those communities have problems. Because a city is made up of what? People. But households. Even today, they always talk about households. Households have power to do things. So thus, if you've got rot inside of households, then what happens to a given community? A neighborhood starts going downhill, because you could see differences even within a city in different neighborhoods. Where you have neighborhoods, even if the people don't have a lot of money, but boy, those households are strong, and they have a derech. Their roads are very well determined, and they know where they're going, and they're going, their roads that those households are on are leading toward places that are, you could say, profitable. They are leading toward life, things that promote life. But if you have households in an area that have a lot of money, but they are on roads that are leading toward places that just lead toward death, what ends up happening? We see that in the neighborhoods around here, what you're talking about here in the area where we live, and in San Francisco, into Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, what ends up happening in those areas? Bunkerism. Basically, you make your fences stronger, your walls higher, you know, security guards, because why? Even though you're rich, your household is just in an island in the midst of rot around there. So thus, you can have neighborhoods that don't have a lot, yet their roads are well-defined. The roads of morality are well-defined, and the places work well. And then you can have neighborhoods that are well-off, yet those areas rot and go down. Because just like with Jeremiah, when you peel away and you look in the inside, the outside may look great. The temple is in operation. They're offering, they're doing the offerings just like they should. The things are, the holy days are happening on schedule, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is actually happening in the inside? There's a heart issue. Yes, the heart issue. The heart is deceitful among all things. So thus, when you're seeing, like in the midst of Jeremiah, those chapters of saying, when you look inside, there is a lot of rot going on amongst the leadership, but encapsulated in the midst of this, there is hope. And one of the great promises and prophecies was that out of Israel was going to come hope, was going to come the deliverer. Yes, Christine, you have a comment or a question?
Well, hello. Yeah, I was just thinking about Rose citing, I think it's the King James Version, and I was recently listening to a wonderful teacher of Torah, and he was saying in Hebrew, it means that the heart is weak and sick. And I noticed in your translation today that we were reading, it mentions sick, but it's really that we just have weak, sick hearts. And Jeremiah went on to say that it's the one who will heal us. And anyway, I just thought about that. It's not necessarily, yeah, I like the Hebrew version of it, It's that we have a weak, sick heart. It's just sick. Yeah.
Indeed. Well, so one of the things that we see is that no matter where we're going, we need shepherds. We need shepherds, and we should always be very careful in evaluating our shepherds, that we don't look for and be snowed by the externals. The externals. Are they tall? Do they speak with a big booming voice? They have a great presentation, get snowed by all kinds of, do they talk really fluently and in all kinds of ways that just make you think everything is glorious, but what, they talk one way, but they behave some other different way. Yes, words are cheap, yes. See what they do. Yes, because that sort of thing is going to show you what they actually value. So whether we're talking about within our own little social groups, when you see like it happens within companies where you may think somebody is wonderful because of their resume or the way that they talk and are presenting themselves, yet when they move into the positions, you start seeing, well, you're not getting the results. Because what happens even within a company, if you've got somebody who's just talking wonderfully, yet what are they actually producing? Your numbers, whether it be widgets, whether it be words, whatever it is that they are actually producing, if that starts going down and the quality starts going down, does it matter that the person looks great, that they present themselves well, and that you've got slick marketing campaigns and you have wonderful looking logos or this or that? No, really? Does that matter? That is the model that we have from God's word, is that things can look great on the outside, but look at the fruits. Yes, it would almost be like someone told a parable about this. So when we see in the Gospels the parables that Yeshua is telling about, you will know a tree by its fruit. So thus you see one of the parables, a kind of a living parable that that Yeshua told about going to a fig tree, and it's very interestingly going to it when it's not a time when you should expect to see figs, and then cursing it. And you're like, well, wait a minute, that's not fair. You're going to it in a time when it's not supposed to be producing figs. Yet, it should be producing figs. So that is an illustration by saying, okay, you're not supposed to be basically living for the test. Because remember from your own education, if you just were doing nothing but studying for the test, what did you actually learn? Do you remember anything from those classes that you just crunched for? You know, where those things where you just, I've got to retain it for like an hour so I can get through the test, then I can forget it all right after that. No. Those are the things that you train on, train on, that you actually retain. So I can think of in my own life that having an internship, those are the things that I actually learned. So when I went through my English grammar courses, and we had to diagram the sentences and this and that and the other, diagramming the sentences, I mean, that just goes in one ear and out the other. But my internship was working as a copy editor for a publishing house. So every single day, several hours a day, I would be sitting there poring over the copy and saying, okay, this is out of joint. These clauses don't fit together. Da-da-da-da-da-da. The subject-verb agreement's not working here. And you are taking those lessons that you have and you had in the class, but you're actually putting them into action. This is like the Shema in action, that you are to talk of these things when you rise up, when you go to sleep, throughout the whole day, whatever you're doing with your children and the people around you, you are to be living these things out. Because if you continually walk them out and not, quote, cram for the test one day a week, then these are things that are actually a part of your walk, and you are actually moving down the road, down the road that the Lord has put out, instead of just spinning your tires and never actually getting going. Yes, Christine.
So in Leviticus, when I was reading it this week, I noticed that there were, you know, it was a big deal not letting the land rest and the, you know, Jubilee year. And then I thought about Shabbat, right? So for us, or to me, it seems, you know, if we're to live as a community, how's our Shabbat? How are we honoring and guarding our Shabbat? Like, are we participating? And it kind of stuck out to me, even as you were speaking just now, that to me, it always kind of comes back to the rest, right? The Sabbath. How are we treating the Sabbath? And then we can keep looking, you know, further into how we keep the land and the Jubilee. And that's for the land of Israel. But for us in the exile, right, it's our Sabbath. You know, it's how are we treating our Sabbath?
Yeah, because in the instructions that we have for the Shabbat, it is because, you know, the one in Exodus, the one that says, because the Lord made the earth in 6 days, the earth and the sea and all that is in them. And then Shabbat on the seventh day, he ceased, stopped on the seventh day. And then as we see, like in Genesis chapter 2, that he blessed the seventh day and hallowed it. He made it holy. He set it apart at that particular point. And then as we see down to Exodus 20, it was set apart to do what? To reflect back on the Creator. So the Creator created over 6 days and then stopped and said, okay, this is set aside. This is a memorial. And as we go on, we remember, hey, when you come around every seventh day, you are reflecting upon who it is that made everything around us. So when we're looking out here, and we see the things that the Lord has made, we can reflect upon the things that we as humans make. We make all kinds of this and that and clothes and all these sorts of things. But to look at the incredible grandeur and the mastery of the things out there that are descended from what the Lord made, that is something completely different. And it shows a difference here, because this, I mean, right now they keep trying to make self-replicating robots and little nano things that when they inject into your body, they can go and repair stuff and then make copies of themselves, etc. But that is one of the things that is unique about the things that the Lord has made. The things that the Lord has made, they have life in them. And they propagate life to life. And so thus, that's one of the things that when we look around and we look outside and we see grapevines, we see trees, we see all kinds of things out there. Those are things that are talking about propagating life to life to life on this. Versus things that are just going to die, decay, become obsolete, we have to get rid of them because we go on to the next little trinket sort of thing. So, when we look at those sorts of things, that life to life to life, thus when we are reflecting on each Shabbat, we reflect upon the one who brings life. Thus, that sort of gives us a picture on, hey, we should also respect life. And what is a lesson that we get from Leviticus again and again and again with the korbanot, the offerings? Life is in the blood. Life is in the blood. So thus, because of life is in the blood, we should be careful about doing what? Shedding blood. Because shedding blood, you're starting to go after the life of whatever it is, whether it's an animal, and especially more if it's a person. Because why? That goes back to Genesis chapter 1. That's right. That's bearing the image of God in each person who's created. So thus, we should really be careful about leaders that are and how they are actually looking over what it is they're responsible for. It's not important about whether they're, quote, present or with it or modern or hip or this or that. It's about whether you are actually looking out for the good of things. It's not about whether you have the latest light show and smoke generator at your events. It is what? If you are actually pointing people towards the things that last and the things that are important, not just about fluff and substance of things. Because we see, like in Matthew chapter 13, verses 11 through 14, to you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has, shall be taken away from him. Therefore, I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled. He said, go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their ears, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. So it's one of those things that at first read on this, you could think, wow, this is almost sounding like the Garden of Eden again with the two trees. That the Lord is setting people up to fail. Is the Lord setting people up to fail? Or is it that another thing of, are you only looking at the superficials here? How is it when you are looking at things, how are you actually observing them? So thus you see in what Yeshua is quoting from the prophet Yeshayahu, and he's saying, render the hearts of these people insensitive and their ears dull or their ears fat so that they just cannot even perceive and the stuff does not get in. Their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, return and be healed. So thus with the Shema, hear and understand. Hear and internalize this. Hear and get this into your hearts. Don't be just someone who hears it and it just immediately forgets it. Yes, Deborah, you have a comment or a question?
Oh, it's all right. Hello. Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that we lack proper teaching. There's so many different versions of the Bible and so many different hundreds of churches and hundreds of different venues, so people can pick whatever they want. You know, the book has been rewritten, but really it comes down to modeling that behavior. And I've often seen people that had nothing to do with church modeling godly behavior that isn't, modeled in the houses of worship, and it's like modeling that good behavior with the parents, but we know that the family is the first thing that the enemy has gone after. So in order to build up a community, we have to be the kind of people that build us up in our group together, build us up good, make sure we're running at high speed and all on the same page as a family with our family meetings and like, what can we do? And then we that will pour out outside, yeah. I think.
Indeed, because, if you have a healthy household, then the people in the households will be healthy to then propagate outward from that. So, yes, indeed. So as we kind of move on with this in Leviticus 26, so when we're seeing that these instructions was observed earlier, hey, these sound a lot like with the Shemitah or the sabbatical year and the Yobel or the Jubilee, we see that there is more to it about those particular illustrations than just about observing these sabbatical years, observing the Jubilees coming around every 50th year. These are kind of, you could say, layers of an onion radiating outward from something in the center of it. Yes, Larry, you have a comment or a question over there? There's a guy talking about curses.
Curses, what that really means is, like, we think of curses as like, I'm going to cast a spell on you, you know, and the spider comes down and eats you or something. And he says what it really was in the Hebrew was that God just withdraws from you and stops covering you. And whatever happens, you do by yourself.
Yeah, I've heard that idea. The problem is that there's the big 50-cent word that is involved with curses, and that's called, you know, imprecatory. Is that you are basically calling down something on something else. You know, for example, a calling down is like what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, where you have, it, you know, talks about the Lord calling down from the Lord the fire, and it came down and destroyed. So, yes, there is the element of leading on into destruction, and you see that with the curses, but there's also the curses that are actually going to be specifically called down. So yes, there's the two types of those. The things that are basically you're being released to your own foolishness and the consequences thereof, and then to the ones, well, this must stop now, and that's why you have an immediate intervention that comes in there. So yeah, that's a good observation for curses, that there's the two elements of it, both what gets called down and then also the basically stepping back and letting disaster ensue. Christine, you had a comment or a question?
Right. I know you're about to take us there. So everything in terms of the Shabbat, the Shemitah, the Jubilee, that's the natural. We are the parable. This is the natural. But we know that everything, or we should, or we're learning, or we're walking in this, the Torah teaches us that everything that's used as an example, right? Like, does God really care about the dirt in Israel? He does. But it has a heavenly connection. There must be some reason why Hashem would, these curses in Leviticus, how can we, you know, Israel as a bride, and we, if we're covenanted in through the merit of, you know, Yeshua and the blood, right? What would possess a husband to come out, and that's what, I just am baffled, and I'm looking forward to further teaching for this today. But it was like, yes, we know that this is in the physical, but there's something in the spiritual realm that we must pay attention to. It's directly correlated in the fact that God does care about the dirt in Israel.
And you bring up a very interesting point. Why would caring about the dirt in Israel be important? Okay, because we come out of the dirt. That's a very good observation. Okay, so you could say the first man, that's his name, Dirt Man, Adama. So Adam came from Adama, so he came out of the dirt. Okay, that's a great observation. So dirt matters. People, yes, are, the Lord fashioned us from dirt. From dust we are, and to dust we'll return. So we should remember that. We are come out of the dirt, okay? Now the question is, well, what makes the difference between dirt in one location and dirt in another location? Garden. The garden? But think about what we were talking about earlier with Shabbat. Shabbat is a, you could say that is a plot of land in time, because it exists and we come across it every 7 days. And we say, okay, there's the 6 days and then there's the seventh day. And then we go through 6 more days and then there's the seventh day. So we move from 6 days into the seventh day and then we move back into the other 6 days again to the seventh day. So there is that place, that land in time, so to speak, that we can say, hey, this is different from everything else. So thus, when we get there, we're like, well, what is this thing for? So thus, he tells us, like in Deuteronomy 5 and Exodus chapter 10, tells us this is related to remember your creator, remember your deliverer. So these are two key things when you come to the Shabbat, you should be remembering. You should be remembering that this is a memorial of the Creator, and this is a memorial of the Redeemer, the Deliverer. So, likewise, in a similar way, if you have a place in space being the land of Israel, what should people think about the land of Israel? Chose it through whom? Told somebody to go somewhere, right? Lech lecha, you know, get going. Go from where you are and go to the place I will show you. And, you know, it wasn't just he said, okay, here's a map, good luck. He actually directed him to the particular place. So thus, when you think about the land, specific land, this is the land, and that's why it's nicknamed the Promised Land. This is the land of the promise. So thus, when you think of the land, you should be thinking this is anchored to a promise, which should start getting some bells ringing about now when you think about land of a promise. Where did Leviticus end? Chapter 27, about vows, which are a type of promise, saying this is something that will happen. I'm sorry, Larry, leave you hanging there for a long time.
It's all right, I didn't want to break in. Anyway, did you say what's the difference between dust and dirt, dust and the land? Did you say that? Is that what you're...
No, I just was talking about why, it was the question that started there about why we should concern ourselves with the dirt in a particular location versus the dirt somewhere else. I mean, you know, we talk about the wine business and they're all about terroir. So they think, oh, they got that land across the street over there and they're obsessed because we're in a particular appellation and it has different terroir than some other place, some other appellation here in our given area. So the terroir across the street is people get into a fight telling you it's different from right over the mountain range, the terroir over there and that sense of place over there. That dirt is different than the dirt over here. So thus, the question is, well, what is the difference about the dirt in the land of Israel? And we were talking about promise. This is a place of the promise. So when you're thinking of the land, you should think of the land of the promised land. So it is a land that without a promise is what? Just a land. So, yes, Larry, I'm sorry.
So
go
when
on.
You said, when I thought you had said that, I was thinking, well, it says from dust you came and to dust you'll
dust
go.
Dust you return, yes.
That is, but if you're talking about land, good land is well watered. It's like the Sabbath is well watered land, right? If you're talking about
great.
It.
Great. That's a good analogy. Observation, yeah.
But whereas dust that you're going to go to, if you die and stay there, is just, it's dry and there's nothing, no life in it.
Yep.
So anyway, that's answering a question that I misunderstood.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting point because, and you bring this up, and that's a part of what you get with Isaiah 40 when he's talking about this, about dust you are and dust you return. Well, a key question is that are you special just because you come out of the dirt? No, because one of the things you see back in Genesis chapter 2, dust, dirt, was formed into dirt man, and then something special happened. the breath of life, and then he became a Nefesh Chaim. So that made that dirt special, is that you had the breath of life breathe into a specific lump of dirt that was fashioned. Yes, Deborah, go on, please.
Okay, and also the minerals and the rock followed them while they were out in the wilderness. Mm. And many people have, the rocks have minerals and nutrients that's particular to that location that God has designed. And when you look in an aerial, you know, it looks, not to be crude, but it looks like a womb, and it's the womb in the center of the earth that God has particularly done something to that land. And it said the rock followed him. And, you know, you can get rocks and drink water. The water comes, it cleanses. So there's something, even the rocks will cry out. So there's something that's going on that it's not naked to the eye, but it's spiritually discerned with the soil and that land. And also we too, I think it's a combination of the location, the people, and the law. That's what we're headed back to, the land of Israel. It's a people, a king and a kingdom, you know? And yeah. So that soil has to have those mechanisms in order for it to function right in the right spirit to create that beautiful Garden of Eden.
Yeah. And you see that when the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, were basically in a timeout, there was still a blessing in particular areas. You see, like, particular people were blessed with Prophet Daniel. You see with, you know, Hadassah, Esther, and Mordecai. So the blessings continued on and followed them. And with Yosef and all the descendants there down there in Egypt, you know, multiplying and being plentiful down there, that blessing followed. But the idea is that they were people that were a part of a promise. And that promise is what made Israel special and makes Israel special. So that when you're thinking of the land, you're thinking of the people, you should be thinking of this promise that started and came earlier. Because that's one of the things that you see when we're going through, like, Ezekiel 36. And it's like, it's not because of how special you are or how holy you are, because of what? It's the one and the promise. The promise that he's made, and when he makes a promise, you can count on it. You can count on it. That's why that there are some particular teachings of basically the plan A, plan B God. And that is dangerous, because you think about that, then what do we even make of the other promises that are available? A big key promise is the one like we have in Genesis 12, that through you, through Abraham, all the nations will be blessed. Well, what if that promise has been revoked? We're all toast. You know, if that one, we can't count on that one, then good luck to anybody else. If the promises that the Lord makes are just fleeting, that we can't count on them, there is no hope. But indeed, there is hope. And we saw that when we were going through Jeremiah. And also, it is very interesting that when you look into as we kind of wrap things up with taking a look at, in our recap of Vayikra or Leviticus, we'll see that Leviticus in and of itself, in the middle of it also, just like in the midst of Jeremiah, where it just looks like there is just a descent, a swirling down the drain of Israel, where it looks great on the outside, but in the inside, it's just rotten. And so the Lord is just going to dismantle that by using a reprehensible nation of Babylon to come in and exact a change, to force a change, to say you're going in the wrong direction. But not just for the sake of saying this club, so to speak, of people, okay, we're going to reform them, great. And so they get the life preserver from heaven, but everybody else just drowns. No, one of the great promises that we were just talking about in Genesis 12 is that through you, all of the nations will be blessed, and that that blessing was going to come to all nations. So if this mechanism, this vehicle for the blessing being the people of Israel and in the land of Israel, all of this cemented into a promise that heaven is making with humanity, this is something that benefits humanity. So to bring the correction, the discipline to Israel benefits the whole world in that. So when Israel gets reformed, it returns, the teshuva happens and it returns and comes back, then that is what? That is a blessing for all nations result from that. But, you know, it's one of those things that Yeshua was talking about, that if the light within you is darkness, how great that darkness is. So if the people of God are to be the light of the world, and that light is darkness, where are people going to go? How can they see? That picture is that the people of God are to be a light when things around just look so dark. Yes, I guess Larry has a comment or a question over there.
Blessing to the whole world that blessing came through them was that was Messiah, wasn't it?
Indeed. That blessing that comes through Israel is the Messiah. That is the key blessing, because that is something that is not only a part of the calling into the world, but it gets at to what we're looking at here with the whole chiastic structure, or the atbash is the way it's represented in Hebrew there, structure of Leviticus, where it begins and ends with offerings and the things that approach. The hearts are approaching with the people of God and the promises in Leviticus 27, 28, or in 27. And in chapters 1 through 7 of Leviticus, we're talking about the various offerings. And when we started Leviticus, we were seeing that this is the thing that approaches. And that is a kind of a key aspect of it. Korban in Hebrew is the thing that approaches. So an offering, its definition is to approach. Well, what is it approaching? Approaching the presence of God. And the presence of the Lord put himself in the midst of the people. And that there is a way to go and approach that presence, even as separate as it is from all of humanity, and how dangerous it is for just humanity to waltz in towards the presence of God. But rather, the Lord says, I'm going to make a way possible to go in. And you see, at the heart of Leviticus is the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, in Leviticus 16. And those two goats of Leviticus 16, those are sin offerings, or chatat offerings. So the korban brings the people to approach the presence. And the chatat takes all of the sins, transgressions, and iniquities of all the people away from the presence and away from the congregation, because that one that is put on the goat for Azazel, the goat for removal, the goat, the scapegoat, that one is taken outside the camp, away from the people. And thus we have, with that great promise of hope we have in Jeremiah 31 with the new covenant prophecy, that he will remove our iniquities and remember them no more. They're not going to come back into camp. No, they are going to be remembered no more. They are removed, and heaven is purposely forgetting them, that they even existed. So when we look at the heart of the book of Leviticus, in the middle of it is the work of the high priest. Leviticus 16:17. where the high priest bears Israel before the presence. And that is one of the key teachings and lessons of it, is that one of the whole vehicles of Israel is the tabernacle. And the key part of the tabernacle is the presence. And the key part of the presence is for things to approach. And then also for that which has approached over time to then be removed. And the key vehicle for that are the offerings and the high priest who makes this happen, especially the Day of Atonement. So thus you see that in the midst of the people of God being a light in the world, in the midst of that is also a demonstration of how Israel is to function in the world, to bring people near, to bring those who are far off, to bring them near towards the presence, and to show that this is available for the entire world. They too can get grafted in to this. This is not a secret club. This is a part of a people that anybody can be grafted into and to join. And that though the old way of life, who you were before you were brought close to the creator of heaven and earth, that the creator has a way that that will be removed. And that in heaven's eyes, you become a new person. You are born again. Just as Israel would be born again with that second generation that goes into the land, with the first generation died off, the second generation will go into the land. Yes, Christine.
So one of the things that I've practiced in my own life is to be mindful of the fact that the tribe of what they call Jews, and we know that that's a collection that everybody's kind of fallen under, is that we appreciate that they held the oracle and were given the oracle, and not to be so dismissive. And I think during our generation, we've experienced a returning to the Torah and being called out from some of the former ideas of replacement theology. And it's just been just such a wonderful experience. And I was using an illustration this morning of my puppy has a pretty aggressive entrance. She tends to run up really quick, stand and stare, and it doesn't always bode as a peaceful transition. And so I often liken myself, in part of the coming from the nations, when I approach my brothers and sisters in Judaism, that I don't make an aggressive run up, you know, or a desperation, or want to put on things of Judaism, right? The bells and the whistles, that I'm not, that I understand the meaning of them, the spiritual meaning of them. And when it's moved, when that heart is transferred and you're drawn to them, that's when you, I don't put a mezuzah up because I'm supposed to, or, you know, I put it up because I've understood it and transitioned. And it's not, you know, I'm always very careful about, you know, not wanting to be a fan of Israel for the sake of being a fan of Israel, but be a brother and sister that comes along my brothers and sisters and studies and learns the one true God.
Indeed, yeah. Oh, no. No worries whatsoever. Because one of the things we saw at our outset, as wrapping things up here today, is a key passage in this particular section of Bechukotai is in Leviticus 26, verses 21 and 22. It says, "If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. I will let loose among you a beast of the field, which will bereave you of your children and destroy your cattle and reduce your numbers so that your roads lie deserted. So thus you see kind of the elements that we were talking about with Larry earlier. That, and we see this also as we get into Numbers with the fiery or the poisonous snakes that come into the community. That basically when, if the Lord were to remove the protection from it, you just have everything will come on in. But this in particular passage is that if you act with hostility against me, when you see a number of takes on this over time, a number of commentators, Jewish commentators on this over several hundred years have all noted a very similar thing, is that this word that is translated as hostility here in the New American Standard Version as keri, that it comes from a root verb meaning kara or something that happens or occurs. So thus you could translate it as if you walk occasionally with me or if you follow the commandments every now and then. And Rashbam says, this is the correct interpretation. If you walk with me only by chance and not regularly, like a man who cannot be relied on to follow the ways of his creator. Or if we were to put this a different way, you might remember what the Apostle Yaakov says there in these letter of James. It's basically like, it is like looking into a mirror and then suddenly forgetting what you look like. So thus, it is like this is not a kind of a, you could say, a secret club sort of thing where you just learn to take the test, so to speak. You just kind of learn it for the test one day a week. This is something that is really becoming a part of how you live, how you treat other people, starting within the household and then moving from the household into the neighborhood and then moving the neighborhood into the city and moving from the city into the nation. And thus, you have a change that happens across the entire world. Yes, Larry, you've got your hand up there.
When you talk about these secret clubs, people just love secret clubs.
We
have our secret handshake, and we do this, and we don't let anybody else in. This is
very
ours.
Exclusionary.
You can't have it.
Yes.
You know, we did it. We did it ourselves, and that's the way it is all around the world. All the different denominations of all the different religions are the same way.
Yeah, to not treat these things like it is some sort of secret club. And that is, you know, it's one of the things we've been looking at in Galatians, and a lot of people have misunderstood what Paul was getting at, but one of the things he was saying is, hey, don't treat the instructions of the Lord as like some sort of exclusionary club where you're just trying to make people jump through your hurdles that you are creating for people. Rather, one of the illustrations that was used at that particular time period was circumcision and also Sabbath observance to basically say, you are a member in good standing if you do this. Well, that was a big factor that came in. It's recorded in Acts chapter 15 of where that came to a head of basically saying, well, wait a minute. Are you saying that you must do this to be saved and for you to enter the kingdom of heaven? And like, did our father Abraham have to do that? No. His circumcision was a sign, a symbol of something that had already happened to him already, something that happened with him inside of his heart. So if that is the one who was called out who got Israel started as a people and that Israel descended out of, then who then are we to say, well, Abraham didn't have it together? Now we really know what it takes to trust the Lord. This is how you do it. He was kind of a simpleton. He really didn't know what was going on. No, rather, that is how it really happens. And that's something that the Messiah and also his herald, Yochanan, or John the Baptist, emphasized. Hey, the Lord can make sons of Abraham out of rocks. Rather, how is it that Abraham and his descendants truly are made? They are the ones who trust the Lord. Whether they are come from one certain ethnicity or another ethnicity, it does not matter. That's where Paul, as we're getting here in Galatians chapter 3, and he says, you know, there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. Because it's not saying, hey, there is no ontological or very by their nature differences between one person or another. It's just saying in God's eyes, for who is going to be in the kingdom, that kind of thing does not matter. That is not what is important. It is about who you are trusting. Do you trust the Lord like Abraham did? If so, that was reckoned to him as righteousness, and it will be reckoned to you as righteousness as well, to trust the Lord and follow him. The elements about, you could say, or lessons of how you are further being, you know, transformed more into being the change agents of the world, the people who are set apart for the mission of bringing the whole world towards God, those things follow, and you learn those things as you learn the testimonies, the witness of the Lord. That's why in Acts 15, verse 21, it says, you know, you do only these four things for these new believers, because their situation was they needed a detox from paganism of their particular time period. So you tell them these are the basic things for them to separate. They're basically kind of like the 12 steps. You have certain steps where you have to realize the things that got you to where you were and then separate yourself from that. So for Acts 15, that was those four things they needed to do to separate themselves from their way of life that was leading them down the road to death. So once you do that, then you are reading. Verse 21 of Acts 15 says, because on every Shabbat, Moses is read in every congregation. Every congregation, they're going to read him. So thus, the testimony of the Lord, the Lord's witness, is going to witness to them by his revelation and say, the Lord will awaken in people. If they truly want to continue moving toward the presence of the Lord, they will hear. Just like we read from Isaiah and Messiah quoted from that. Just like they will hear and understand. They will see and understand. They will see. It wouldn't be like they see it, they hear it, and it's like, eh, you know, it doesn't really apply to me, whatever. I'm sorry, Daniel, I'll leave you hanging there.
What you're talking about with like slowly walking away from God, like over time with like religion too. I feel like it started with people believing in Jesus, right? But now, like, even at school in theology, like, my teacher says obviously like really good stuff, but then you feel like when he's talking, I'm like, it feels like they just, Christians believe that when Jesus came, the Bible isn't relevant anymore. Yeah. And then people start walking away from the Bible, and then they just believe, oh, hey, did you see what this guy wrote? And I'm like, well, have you seen what God wrote? You know, like, maybe you should look at the origin first and use that to check. Because, like, when we're at school, my teacher was like, we don't have to listen to what the old she was like, oh, all the rules were dealt away with when Jesus died on the cross and all that. And I was like, hold up. Just because Jesus died on the cross, yes, we don't have that burden of sin on us as much as it was before Jesus died on the cross, but we still have to follow God's rules. It's not like, oh, Jesus died, now I don't need to follow the rules anymore. Like, yes, you do. God made those rules for a reason. Like,
yeah. In one of those things that you can also add there, that the Apostle Paul talks about the very good interplay between the instructions of God and also what the true solution is. And those are in Romans chapter 7 and Romans chapter 8. Because actually in Romans chapter 6, he addresses this also. But he's talking about basically when he says, he's asking questions about himself. It's called rhetorical questions, where you ask a question and you're going to answer it yourself. And he uses these illustrations about saying, well, is the law sin? Well, may it never be. But one of the things he talks about in Romans chapter 7 is that the law shows you, wow, I am dealing with a totally other. God is other from me. And when I approach this, just like I'm walking in towards the tabernacle, I cannot just waltz right in there, because you cannot go in uninvited. Otherwise, you will die. That's an emphasis of the tabernacle. So like in Romans 7, it says, at the end of it, who can save me from this body of death? Because Paul is writing there saying, when you put yourself up against God and his otherness, there is no way that you can actually survive here. So you are left with the sense that you are going to be facing death, separated away from the giver of life. But when you go into Romans chapter 8, how is it beginning? Therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Messiah Yeshua. If you are in Messiah Yeshua, the high priest, where does the high priest go? Into the presence of God. And we see that talking about in Hebrews chapter 9, where we can go in with confidence through the veil because of the blood of Messiah. Because the blood of Messiah takes us into the presence, has the open invitation to go into the presence. So thus, that is how the law and the mercy of God work together. The law is pointing us to where the source of life is and where the true solution is. Just like in the Torah, that's why so much of the Torah is the tabernacle, because that shows us both the problem and the solution in there. But also in the solution, the key aspect of it in Leviticus 16 shows us that even with the solution, it is something other than what humanity can actually provide. And we see that today when you have no temple that is standing, how do you restart the temple? And it's the whole thing about the red heifer. But then there's a question, who can offer a red heifer? That's a very, it's a conversation that goes back centuries, where many say that only the Messiah, an agent from heaven, can initiate and do the red heifer to even get a temple back in operation. So thus you have a built-in lesson within the Torah saying there is a problem in the world living completely apart from the Creator. There is a solution. And the Creator doesn't want to just live off who knows where, but wants to be in the middle of the people, wants to be among the people. And there is a way that this is going to be taken care of. And that solution also came from heaven, and that is the Messiah. So that thus the problem and the solution are thus encapsulated in the Torah. And that is one of Paul's main points that you have in both the letter of Romans and also in Galatians. And Lorilla has been just hanging there. Yes, go ahead, please. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, please.
Okay. I just wanted to, congratulate Danielle on getting this about 50 years before my cousin did. So my cousin and I were having a discussion, and it wasn't really an argument, it was a discussion about why am I looking back at the Old Testament? And I said, because that is the beginning, and the New Testament is the continuation of that, but you're not to reject. And He quoted some person who had written a sermon around 1890. And I'm not going to name the name because I'm sure many of the things that he said were quite accurate. And, you know, I don't want to blow anybody out of the water. But, well, according to Dr. So-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, why are you quoting him? He says, well, because, you know, he's older and he's from the previous generation. He understands. And I said, I got one that's even older than that and more biblically sound. And he said, who would that be? And I said, Paul. And he said, well, but Paul said, blah, blah, blah. I said, you're quoting out of context. Once again, dear heart, you know, what does he actually say? And we chaptered and versed it. And the poor dude was left with nothing. So, you know, it's like we need to not, you know, as Danielle refused to do, just go with the quote. Just read it, understand it for yourself. Ask wise people if you don't quite get it, but why throw out half of what we believe just because somebody said, well, it's inconvenient?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that sometimes people will say, well, you have a lot of Christianity as just tossed away the instructions of God. But you see, that's not really entirely the case, because if you actually see a lot of what their teachings are, you'll see that they have sort of incorporated back in the instructions of God without saying that they really have done so. But one of the challenges that you have is that you are basically kind of ad hoc adding things back in. Well, under what authority did you toss it out, and under what authority are you bringing it back in again? And then you also have a challenge in today's society about, well, then, when you have these questions that come up, which were questions at the time of Moses, and they were at the time of Yeshua and the time of the prophets, and for hundreds of years since then, when these questions come up, what then do you do about them? Do you move along with the times? Or do you go back to where the foundations of the things are on today? Whether you're talking about a thing that people are struggling with today, about, you know, who they are, where you actually find your identity in things, a huge struggle when you encounter all kinds of problems on this. When you actually take it back to what the identity that we find in the Messiah and the identity that we find as people, where do we first start? We start first at the beginning. We start at the beginning, and he says that he in the beginning, he created them male and female. And that is how we see things propagating from one generation to the next, both physically and also, you could say, morally and spiritually. Now, the challenge that we have today is there are many, many pressures that people have and the struggles that they face of things that have happened in their lives, things that have happened in their backgrounds, terrible, terrible things that have happened with them to make them want to pull back from how the Lord made them. I mean, you can just think of superficial things about how tall you are. There's no way you can do that. I mean, you can. There's actually ways that you can go in and they can break your bones and just keep incrementally adding length to them by putting spacers in. It is unbelievably painful. And over time, hopefully they will get the strength back into it. So you can become taller, but wow, that is difficult. And they really can't do anything about your spine. They can do things about your arms and your legs, but you're still as tall as you are. And that's just one superficial thing. But what about the other things that people don't like about themselves?
Yeah, male
and female, other things that cause them to not want to be that, whether it be girls not wanting to continue on into womanhood, whether it's boys that don't want to continue on into manhood. All of us come into our situations one way or the other. So how is it that we come into learning about the reasons why male and female exist and what a man is supposed to do and what a woman is supposed to do and why you actually have the compatibility together. Yeah. It's not the caricatures, both for the man and for the woman. Those are the things that you see the instructions of God help you sort out and line it up into place. So current generations will try to reinvent the wheel a lot because they say that which is old has to go away and that which is new must replace it. There are legitimate issues that people will bring up, things about all kinds of inequality and oppression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But is the solution worse than the issue? And that is one of the things that you see has to be addressed by every single generation. Every single generation has to come in. Do we want the ways of the past? And do we see that the ways of the past are helpful for not only the present, but also for the future? And sadly, we've seen that with some of the experiments in more modern times of just basically kicking out the pillars of things. Now, some pillars had to go. Those that related to oppression and such, those have to go. But the things that actually hold up individual households and communities and those things, those are the ones that should learn about some of the pillars that are there before going to kick them out. And that is where you see what we were talking about earlier with Acts 15, that you, week by week, you go through and you are hearing and reading and learning about the instructions of God on these things. And the Spirit of God will open our eyes to different things at different times. Those are things that we may not see in the first time through. And I know I've seen things decades later that I just, it's like, wow, was that in there before? I never saw that before. Well, it's been there for thousands of years. Suddenly, it's the living word indeed. So, any last thoughts here before we close out today? All right, so next Shabbat, Lord willing, we'll start on into the book of Numbers, Bemidbar in the wilderness, which is a great one because you get to see where this, it starts out and you think, oh my goodness, what is this, a census document where it's going in and labeling things and counting people and counting people by shekels. And so just as we saw at the end of Leviticus, you see about vows and shekels. We'll see as we start the next book about census for the army and shekels again. So you can look at it on the outside and see, well, what is this? People are just reduced to money? Or is it that you're seeing something else, which is actually related to the tithe? Because what did we read about in the tithe in our portion here today? The 10th one that comes through, good or bad, that is the one that's selected. Meaning what? To put it in a separate way that Paul put it, there is neither Jew nor Greek, nor slave nor free, male nor female. It is basically that the Lord is not looking on the outside of things. And that is one of the key things that we'll see moving on into the book of Bemidbar or Numbers, is that the Lord is not looking on the outside. And the sooner that people will be learning that lesson, whether we read about what Israel was learning 3,500 years ago, or what we see going on in our world right every day today, we'll see that the things that are going on within us and the things that we are chosen for and heaven is working with us on are not the things we see on the outside. Because we can put a great mask on the outside, just like we read in Jeremiah today. But what's going on the inside is reprehensible, where you have basically got us to hit the reset button and start it over again.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.